Welcome to Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to be here. We had a wonderful show last week. We began talking about Charles V, and I'm looking over at our syllabus today, and we will begin talking about him again today.
We'll be still talking about him, especially some affairs that are going on in Germany at the time. But before we do that, you know, we've gotten a couple emails from some of our radio fans and had some questions about history, so I boned up on a couple things, and I wanted to share some of that with us.
That's great. That's really exciting to get those questions coming in.
Yeah, that was neat. Well, one of the questions came from Anita, and she was asking about the movie Elizabeth, which had come out a couple years ago.
Right.
And it's a very interesting film. Actually, the best thing about the film is the music.
Okay.
But it's okay. But it perpetuates a myth or a story that was started by William Cecil. Mm-hmm. And the scene that we're talking about is supposedly a Jesuit who has snuck into England with the intention of murdering Elizabeth the First. And actually it's a combination of two things that are mixed together, and you end up with a story which is absolutely not true.
Okay.
So anyway, here are some of the things. First of all, one thing is true, and that is that there were a lot of Jesuits and other priests being sent into England in a clandestine way in order to evangelize the people. In March of 1583, some 230 priests entered England, and they were there, first of all, to go into Catholic homes and to continue celebrating the Eucharist and the sacraments and baptizing the Catholics in an underground, because it was illegal to do that publicly. And so they were continuing the faith on, but in the homes themselves. In fact, many of the homes built around that time have special doors they call priest's doors. And they're hidden doors and hidden chambers, so that if the government forces came to go into your home and search out the priest or any popish stuff that you might have, like chapels or rosaries or whatever, that they would hide them in those little chambers. And so it is true that there were priests in England, and they were there in a clandestine way. That's true. They were also there to convert. In fact, in one shire, some 400 people were converted by a group of priests. There's still a lot of love for the Catholic Church, even in Elizabethan England. It's just very, very dangerous to try to express that. Another thing they did, too, was they were instrumental in the translation, the English translation of the Bible, which we used all the way down into the 20th century, called the Douay-Rheim version. And our older Catholics and older listeners would be well aware of that. It's a beautiful translation that has been since supplanted. But that's another one of the things. And the other thing they did was they died for their faith. They used to refer to service in England as "come rack, come rope." And that's exactly what would happen to them. 12 of them met a martyr's death, and we're talking a horrible martyr's death, being racked and then being hung, or the other way around. And then another 40 whiled away in prisons, were caught and put into terrible prisons. In fact, the torture that's shown in the film Elizabeth is a pretty good example of what these men went through. Second thing, the second trend in this is the plot itself. There was, in fact, a plot to kill Elizabeth I. It was hatched in June of 1583, and it was hatched in, I believe, Paris, in France for sure, but I think the meeting was in Paris. And the ringleader behind this was the Duke of Guise. So it's a French layman who was intending to kill kill Elizabeth. That's a Freudian slip, because in fact there's only one queen that dies during that period, and it is Mary, Queen of Scots, and it's at the hands of Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. So instead of being the victim of regicide, she is in fact the perpetrator, but you see how the myth is switched around.
Mm-hmm.
There were two Jesuits who attended that meeting along with a number of other French and Spanish officials. And as I say, they attended the meeting when the discussion took place. Whether they played any role in the discussion or not is another question. We know that the information that this meeting had taken place, that there was an intention of invading England by France and Spain, that there was a consideration of an assassination of the Queen, talked about at that meeting, and that information was given to one of the papal secretaries. But it was made very clear at that meeting and afterwards that the Pope was not to be told about this. Okay. And, you know, there are two reasons for that, probably. One is that you don't want the Pope to know about. There's some things that you don't want the sovereign to know. But the other thing, too, is that as the sovereign, as the vicar of Christ, he might very well have ordered them not to do it, and therefore the plot could not have taken place. So they simply didn't tell the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
There was a spy who was captured. He was a layman. He was racked three times before he revealed. Now, we're talking in terms of being placed on a device that literally stretches your arms and legs to the limit, even to the point of the sinew breaking. It's an incredibly terrible, hideous torture. And this man was racked three times before he finally broke. And when he did, he revealed... revealed this plot. It's known as the Throckmorton plot because the spy's name was Throckmorton. He was not a priest. He was a regular old guy, a spy. I'm sorry, he was... then the whole story was turned by William Cecil, as I'd mentioned before, and it turns out that that Elizabeth has made this big victim, where in fact she is the regicide. She's the one who actually does this. Anyone who's interested in knowing more about this, I'd really recommend Warren Carroll's book, his fourth volume in his History of Christendom, The Cleaving of Christendom, Volume 4, and you get a good description of the plot and what happened, who the characters are. Okay.
That's great. Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Sure.
Just a side note. I've never seen Elizabeth, but the movie. But in Braveheart, don't they show a someone
That's
on the
right.
rack?
There is
in
a
the
rack.
End of that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I believe, if I remember correctly, the end of the film, Braveheart, Wallace is captured. He is hanged, racked. And I don't think they show the quartering.
They don't show it, but that's how near the end that he's going to be quartered or whatever.
It seems
to be. I think that's how it ends.
The easiest way to do that, of course, is simply to take four horses, tie the victim to the four horses at the four limbs, and then send the horses off in different directions. It is incredible. It is sadistic. At the same time, it is very convincing of everyone who has to watch this that you don't want to cross that guy.
Yeah. I'm just amazed, though, that you said this guy was racked three times. I would find it hard that you could even survive that.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, you know, I'm afraid. I'm such a wuss. I would take one look.
Yeah.
They'd show me the instruments. I'd go, what do you want to know? You know?
Oh.
Yeah, but it just goes to show you the strength of you know, the intensity. Oh, I should also mention to you that the Duke of Guise himself was assassinated.
Oh, my gosh.
He was shot in the back with a poisoned bullet and died about 6 days later. He died on Ash Wednesday. And his assassin, the man who hired the assassin to kill him, the guy who arranged it, was a French admiral. The Admiral de Coligny, who was a leader of the Huguenots, the Calvinists, who himself was assassinated a couple years later by literally being ripped apart into pieces in his bed as he slept.
Ooh.
This was a violent age.
Okay.
Well, let's go on to some happier news.
Yeah, let's do.
Yeah. We had another question from Bob, and it had to do with, early church, which is not exactly my area of interest, but our expertise. But I did a little research, and I found some really interesting things. He was asking about the city of Sinope, which is in Turkey. It's a port city on the Black Sea. And quite honestly, being a modern historian, when I hear Sinope, the first thing I think of is the massacre of Sinope, which took place in 1856.
Okay.
A Russian fleet sailed into Sinope and just blew away a Turkish fleet that was unaware of that they were about to go into battle.
Wow.
And they were just destroyed, and the city was pummeled. And actually, this was the last straw that led to the Crimean War. When Britain and France came, and Italy, or actually Piedmont, Sardinia, Piedmont, came to the aid of the Turks in fighting the war against Russia, the Crimean War. you know, the charge of the light brigade and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So Sinope has a kind of a current history. It's, you know, it's 150 years ago. It was in the newspapers also. But Bob's question was concerning the early Christian community of Sinope. Sinope is the capital of the Roman province of Pontus.
Okay.
We see that several times mentioned in the New Testament, especially the Acts of the Apostles. The full name of it was Hellenopontus. And as I say, Sinope was the capital of that. Later on, there's a bishop that's going to be there. The sources that I found say that it was not St. Paul who evangelized this region, but rather either St. Peter or followers of St. Peter. So it has a Petrine setting. It had a thriving Jewish community in the first century A.D. With that, conversions, a lot of Christians coming over at the same time. A bishop in that area. In fact, today there is still a titular diocese of Sinope.
Hmm.
Pope Leo XIII set up these titular dioceses that we have that we use today, and so it's still around. It suffered terrible persecutions in the first century, around 90 AD, under Domitian. And then later on, a couple hundred years later, it became the center of controversy again with the Bishop Marcion, who is from Sinope. And he's the leader of what becomes known as Marcionism. It's one of the early church heresies in which he denied the godship of the God of the Old Testament and accepted only Jesus as sort of a spirit or an angel. And as a result of that, there's this great heresy. A lot of times, something good comes out of heresy, and in this particular case, what came out of it was the canon of the Bible,
okay,
and the reaffirmation of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's Sinope, and that's the history behind it. It does have a very ancient history.
Well, interesting.
Yeah.
And Bob, thanks for that question.
Yeah.
And now,
okay,
back into Charles in Germany.
Yeah, this the title of this talk is this little presentation is "Killing Christians in the Name of Christ: The Schmalkaltic War," or what I thought of as another subtitle would be "The Little War with a Great Big Name." Now, you know, where on earth did the Germans come up with a name like Schmalkaltic?
I was going to ask you what it meant.
It doesn't mean anything. It's
really?
It's the name of a town.
Okay.
Yeah, Schmalkalt is the name of the town. And the reason why it got its name is, or it got attached to the name, is that a number of German nobles met at Schmalkalt, and they formed a league, which they simply call the Schmalkaltic League.
Okay.
Say that three times with a cracker in your mouth.
Right.
I'm going to tell you who they are, but right now it probably doesn't mean a heck of a lot to you, these particular names. The Elector of Saxony, that should mean something because he's the protector of Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The Landgrave of Hesse, who will mean something a little bit later on. Two of the Dukes of Brunswick. The Prince of Anhalt, two Counts from Mansfeld, the city of Magdeburg, and the city of Bremen.
Okay.
Now, most of this doesn't mean a heck of a lot. The Elector of Saxony, we've heard of him before. The city of Magdeburg should mean something to us because that's one of the three cities that Albert had control of as bishop. Remember, mm-hmm. Magdeburg, Hoverstadt, mm-hmm. and Mainz.
Mainz, okay.
Yeah. And in Magdeburg becomes a Lutheran city, a very strong Lutheran city. And then Bremen, it's a port city up in the north, did also. So they farmed together at Schmalkalt, and they farmed together this league. They spent Christmas of 1530 together from December 22nd to December 31st. And what they did was they as noblemen, they accepted what was called the Augsburg Confession, which is the creedal statement of Lutherans.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Lutherans mm-hmm. believe. And so they accepted that. And then, this is even as significant or more significant, they then vowed to defend Lutheranism with the sword.
Wow. Okay.
So here now you have, for the first time, at least in Germany, you're going to have Christians who are going to take up the sword to defend their brand of Christian theology. This is unique. It had happened already in Switzerland, and you'd hope that the Germans would have learned from the Swiss example, where Ulrich Zwingli wasn't satisfied with preaching the gospel. He organized military forces. They went out to try to conquer Catholic Swiss. Terrible battle. He's killed in battle. Here you have, you know, killing Christians in the name of Christ. And now the Germans are getting themselves ready to do the same thing with the Schmalkaldic Lake. Yeah. In fact, later his body, Zwingli's body, was found, and it was taken by the Swiss forces and beheaded, and then his body was quartered and burned.
Wow.
It's pretty severe. Not magnanimous in victory, you know.
Right.
The Diet of Augsburg, the Diet is the imperial parliament that meets together on occasion. Okay. And in all of this is really prompted by the Diet, or the gathering, at Augsburg in 1530. It's the first visit that Emperor Charles V had made to Germany since the Diet of Worms in 1521. And this was, remember, this was the Diet where Luther was put on trial, and he stood before all the people, and in German, you know, he changed the language and said, "Here I stand, I can do no other, God help me." And then after that, some of his followers then ferreted him away, mm-hmm. spirited him away to Wartburg Castle, where he lived under sort of like the cover for a year, and then made his way back to Wittenberg. Okay, so Charles had such a bad experience, he didn't come back for, you know, another 19 years or something like that. But when he comes back, he is encouraging Catholics to dialogue with Lutherans.
Okay.
To try to come to some understanding. Here is one of the interesting problems that secular leaders will always have with religious problems. They're always looking for some kind of a political solution. Well, we can compromise this. Just change your faith on this part or that part. You know, they don't realize what they're dealing with mm-hmm. here. And in this case, he really placed a lot of his a lot of confidence in two Catholic theologians. One of those was John Eck, who had earlier on debated with Martin Luther,
mm-hmm.
and now was still very much, he's a real Catholic apologist in this period. And so John Eck, and then another man by the name of Campeggio, who was the papal legate to Charles V, but quite a theologian himself. And so the two of them then are urged to meet with Luther and with Melanchthon and others, and to try to come to some kind of a clear understanding of the Catholic position and exactly where the Catholic Church saw heresy in Luther's position, so that there could be some kind of dialogue and ultimately understanding. Melanchthon then also met with yet another secretary to the emperor, a Spaniard by the name of Alfonso de Valdés. And Valdés is one of the great humanists of the era. Remember the Christian humanists?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
By now, Thomas More is in deep trouble over in England. By now, Erasmus is got his own situation going on in Germany. Both men are not too many years off from death. But you do have a number of other humanists, and some of whom we don't know about in the English-speaking language. But, you know, in Europe, they're still well-known. And in this case, Alfonso de Valdés is one who is sent by the emperor. He's a secretary to the emperor to meet with Philip Melanchthon, the chief theologian for the systematic theologian for Martin Luther. Remember that Martin Luther is a scripture scholar. He's not a systematic theologian. So he gets out of his field when he gets into some of this stuff. Melanchthon, who is an expert in the Greek language, had been hired at the University of Wittenberg to teach Greek, has a real mind for systematic theology. And so the two of them meet, and they're trying to work out some compromises, you know,
mm-hmm.
and the best they could do was some surface stuff. You know, they said, okay, fine. What about using the cup at communion. And so they were willing to allow Lutherans who would return to the Catholic Church to receive the body and blood of Christ under both species. That's kind of a surface.
Okay.
It doesn't touch theology.
Uh-huh.
Then there was some questions about clerical celibacy. They agreed that Lutherans who returned to the church would be able to maintain their married state and yet be restored as clergy. Some other liturgical forms, the use of vernacular in some cases, things of that nature. But the fact of the matter is that those are little surface things that are not touching at the real differences. And that's when Luther came in and basically took the Augsburg Confessions and said, here, this is the basis. We'll work off of this. And it was unacceptable. The Catholics simply could not accept that. The best they could do, the Catholics and Lutherans, best they could do in these discussions was to agree that the Zwingliites and the Anabaptists were wrong.
Okay. That shouldn't have been too difficult.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because both of them. You know, and then there's a lot of grandstanding that goes on. Martin Luther presents this tract, which is entitled Augustana. Okay, outlining his position. The Catholics then come back and they have another called Confuciato, okay, in which they're confronting those. And then Melanchthon comes back with an apologia.
Okay.
You know, so they're doing a lot of grandstanding. And the fact of the matter is that they're not getting very far. Mm-hmm. Finally, another force from outside tries to come in and break the impasse that would cause the Catholic position to crumble and everyone accept a modified Lutheran position. And this is none other than Martin Bucer.
Okay.
Now, we've talked a little bit about him before. He's a former Dominican at the University of Strasbourg who has accepted the ideas of predestination and has broken with Rome. He gathers together four cities that will all agree. That here we get again city councils and city universities, just like we saw, you know, in Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
and they're making theological statements.
Mm-hmm.
And so these cities then present their own doctrinal statement, which they call the Tetrapolitana, the four cities, the statement of the four cities: Strasbourg, Constance, Lindau, and Memmingen. These four very Protestant cities now then make a statement which is sort of along the lines of Martin Luther, but at the same time not entirely. But all that does is just get things all more messed up.
Complicated.
Yeah. This thing goes on for almost a year.
Wow.
And finally, Charles is absolutely frustrated. And on April 15th of 1531, he simply makes the statement, okay, that's it. Now, you guys come back to the Catholic Church, and that's all there is to it. He put his foot down.
Okay.
And Luther hardened his position.
Mm-hmm.
And so it looked like there was going to be civil war. And the Schmalkaldic League, of course, was starting to arm itself. Now, that's why you have the Schmalkaldic League. And at the same time, Charles finds himself absolutely stymied because he's got so many foes at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the German Protestants. Then he's looking over his back, and you've got none other than Francis I. You know, and he allies himself. This sounds absolutely incredible, but it's absolutely true. Francis I allies himself with Pope Clement VII against Charles. Now, think to yourself, now why on earth would a pope be standing in the way of a Catholic emperor trying to bring Catholicism back to
Germany?
And the answer has to be that Charles, he's got so many hats.
Mm-hmm.
One of those hats is also a military conqueror of Italy. And so Clement is concerned that Charles is riding herd over Italy and taking away papal independence. Now remember, he's got a point, actually, because 4 years earlier, an imperial army went on a rampage.
Wow.
And it sacked the city of Rome in 1527. And people have not forgotten that. Mm-hmm. It was an imperial army, but it was made up mainly of Lutheran soldiers. Mm-hmm. And they mm-hmm. did incredible havoc and damage to the city of Rome. And so there's just so many sides to this, mm-hmm. you know, that it's a prism. It just really is not a us and them kind of a right. deal. And so you do have Clement then siding with, because of Italian politics, siding with the French, which would stymie, of course, the Charles in Germany. Then, on top of that,
and the French have sided with the Turks.
Good, I'm glad you mentioned the Turks, because the Turks are once again on the borders in Eastern Europe, and Charles has to deal with this too. Well,
how did he sleep at night? Okay.
Well, you know, after he put his foot down, uh-huh. he did the next best thing he could and just basically forgot that he had said anything.
Okay.
He let the deadlines pass, everything. And so instead, in the summer of 1532, he then makes a new announcement.
Okay.
And this is called, and this was at the Diet that was held in Nuremberg. And so it's called the Nuremberg Recess. And basically what Charles promised was this. He said to all the Protestants, look, we won't attack you. We will not attack you. The imperial forces will not attack you until there is a council, an ecumenical council that is formed, and is finds Lutheran positions to be in heresy. Then at that point, we will attack you, or you probably won't, because you'll probably recognize your error and come back to the church. Okay.
Okay.
So now the Lutherans in Germany feel relatively safe.
Okay.
Charles is a man of his word. If he mm-hmm. says he's not going to attack, he won't attack. And so they feel relatively safe. And they figure, okay, fine, we have a consul. And if we have a consul on our terms, we can win this. They believe enough in their theology that mm-hmm. to believe that given a consul on their terms, And they try to manipulate, fail in doing that. But on their terms, they think that they can win in a council.
Okay.
And so they're willing now to stand behind the emperor and to put off the attack of the Ottoman Turks and to save Eastern Europe from Islam.
Okay.
And this is exactly what they do. They gather together an army of some 80,000 men. It's a pretty good size army for those days. And added to that, you also have in Hungary a lot of guerrilla forces, basically, partisans. And between the partisans in Hungary and the this new imperial Catholic force that comes down into the Danube River, Suleiman the Magnificent doesn't look so magnificent anymore, and he withdraws his troops. And so, you know, there's another interesting aside on all of this, too, that in the midst of this, in Romania, what is present-day Romania, which is actually three provinces, Moldavia, Wallachia, and then the big one, Transylvania.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
One of those partisans who was fighting to free his country from the Turks was a man known as Vlad the Impaler. And he was a pretty rugged character himself.
Something you don't want to cross.
Definitely. You know, impaling is just mm-hmm. a really lousy way to die.
Mm-hmm.
And Vlad was pretty good at it. He struck fear into his enemies, and especially the Turks. His nickname or his family symbol was that of the dragon. I don't know any Romanian, but I do know the word for dragon in Romanian is Dracul. And believe it or not, this is the guy who becomes the grist of the story of Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Uh-huh.
Comes out of that. And actually, he's a freedom fighter at this time, fighting
okay.
against the Turks
okay.
to free his country.
Well, interesting.
Yeah, a little fun fact in
yeah.
history there. Yeah. Well, anyway, Charles succeeds in stymieing the Turks, but he can't drive the Turks out of Eastern Europe. You know, he gets only so far, and then he finds himself once again having to go back to Italy to defend his positions in Italy because the French have once again invaded. And so here, poor Charles is using limited resources, fending off Protestants in Germany, Turks in Eastern Europe, Italians and the Pope, and the French all at the same time. it's just miserable. The break for Charles comes when there's a new pope elected,
okay.
Pope Paul III.
Okay.
He reigns from 1534 to 1549, and he is very, very interested in reform. He really wants to do this. He attempts to pull together a council, and unfortunately nobody comes. It's the Council of Mantua, which doesn't happen, mainly because Francis I wouldn't allow any of the French cardinals to come, the French bishops or cardinals to come, and it was too dangerous for the Germans to travel, and the Spaniards never got around to it, and the Italians never left either, and so he ended up with a council with nobody there. In the process of calling a council, there is a reaction from the Germans, the Schmalkaldic League, in which they established what they call the Schmalkaldic Articles, and these were going to be the ground rules for a council in which they would participate.
Okay.
Okay. And these, I mean, you know, you can see these coming down the pike.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number one, there will be no papal influence. Now,
okay.
A council needs a pope to call it. And we've learned that at Constance, all the great councils. But in this case, they're denying that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Secondly, everyone will be represented, not just bishops and priests and people of that nature. All estates will be represented, and that of most importance then are going to be the university professors. The Pariti will run this council. That's their intention to do that. Number three, the council will be, all decisions of the council will be based solely upon Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't prove it in Scripture, you can't have it. And then fourthly, just to make sure that they've got control, it must be held on German soil.
Of course.
Well, so they've hardened their position,
mm-hmm.
and they're toughening themselves up. They're looking at an emperor who's distracted by too many things going on, a pope who wants to pull off a council and is moving in that direction, but is not able to get the secular authorities to give him the bishops that he needs in order to do a true Catholic council.
Mm-hmm.
And in the midst of all of this, while the Schmalkaldic League looks like it is really calling the shots, I mean, you know, they're setting out some pretty tough standards for the Pope to, you know, to have to kowtow to. In the middle of all this, one of the most important people in the Schmalkaldic League gets himself into trouble.
Okay.
I had mentioned that one of the leaders of the Schmalkaldic League was the Landgrave of Hesse. And it's a powerful position in Central Europe. It turns out that he is married to the daughter of Duke George of Saxony.
Okay.
And he doesn't particularly care for her, but he does have a little thing on the side.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And he, after he comes over to Lutheranism, he realizes that that adultery is a sin. And he has looked at his life and he realizes that he cannot live in this unholy union. Okay, now what did Henry VIII do? Well,
mm-hmm.
he just began divorcing women one right after another. In this case, Philip of Hesse is not able to divorce his wife because her father is a very powerful German prince. So he goes to Luther and says, "What do I do? You know, I love this other woman, but I can't have her in adultery. That would be a sin." And Luther's solution to him is marry her. Well, I can't.
I'm married.
Marry, because I am married. No, go ahead and do it quietly. Believe it or not, Philip of Hesse is counseled into bigamy. To being married secretly to this other woman at the same time being publicly married to his wife. And so he is secretly married in the spring of 1540 to this woman. Her name is Margaret von der Saal. And now he's got these two women, and he says to Luther, "Can I do this?" Now, this is a quote. And I got this from a Lutheran historian.
Okay.
And Luther says the following. He says, tell a good strong lie for the sake and the good of the Christian church. So this marriage takes place, but it's secret. Okay, and it's held in secret and probably could have continued being held in secret. And that's exactly how they would like to have done it.
Oh, yeah.
Kept it in a closet for the rest of Philip's life, for the rest of Margaret's life, for the rest of his original wife's life. But there's a complication that takes place.
Okay.
And it comes from a little tiny district that is of no significance at all under any other circumstance. And it's the little German district of Cleves.
Okay.
Now, what's interesting about Cleves, of course, if you remember from Henry VIII, he accidentally marries the Anne of Cleves.
Yeah.
Remember,
yeah,
who ends up being a very ugly woman, and of
right.
course, you know, we know that story. But what happens is that William of Cleves inherits a significant amount of land, and is technically a vassal of Charles V, although he is himself a Lutheran, a Protestant,
okay,
and disobedient to Charles.
Okay.
And he begins his own diplomatic maneuvering to make Cleves, from being a tiny little district, being a powerful force in Europe. I mean, he marries his daughter, at least for a couple weeks, off to the King of England. That makes a very powerful alliance.
Oh.
He has another daughter who is married off to the Elector of Saxony, brings him into the Schmalkaldic League. Then Charles finds out that he is negotiating with Philip I of France.
Oh.
Ooh. So Charles begins pulling his stuff together in order to go and punish William of Cleves.
Right.
He needs help. He needs help because the Schmalkaldic League can ally against him, and he doesn't have a lot of power. And it's at this point, unexplainable in history, but it's at this point that Philip of Hesse figures that he can solve all of his problems by going to Charles V, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, and say, look, I know that I'm a member of the Schmalkaldic League, I know that I'm a Lutheran and everything else, but I want to be your friend. I think you and I can bring about a reunification of the churches in Germany. We can bring about peace in Germany, and we'll be allies. And just to show you how much I trust you, Charles Emperor, I've got a secret.
Oh, no. Oh, yay. Oh, no. Okay.
And he tells Charles the whole thing.
Oh, my gosh.
Boy, talk about, you know, moving into
in the
it.
Aces. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it absolutely backfired.
Oh, sure.
You know, first of all, Charles is abhorred. You know, he is a devout man.
Right.
You know, good family man on top of everything else. He is absolutely abhorred at this. And so what he does is, he turns around and he makes the whole thing public.
Uh-huh.
And it embarrasses the Schmalkaldic League. It embarrasses Martin Luther, Philip Melanchthon, the whole group. And the Schmalkaldic League as a military force just really collapses around this. Well, Charles can't take advantage of this, unfortunately, because although now Philip is embarrassed, the Schmalkaldic League is in shambles. It's right at that moment that Francis I succeeds in bringing about this great alliance against Charles.
Oh.
In 1542, listen who you have against him. You've got France, the Ottoman Empire, and Cleves. Well, Cleves isn't much, you know, especially now.
Well, he kind of made a mess out of that one.
Anne's back home, going to the beauty parlor. he gets Sweden, Denmark, to come in, and even Scotland.
Wow.
Even Scotland. It looks as though a French alliance with all of these Lutherans is going to bring about the end of the empire. And even some of the bishops wimp out at this point. Albert of Mainz, you know, that weasel of German history, turns around and he sends a message to Magdeburg, which he is still technically the bishop of, and says to the Protestants, I will recognize your church. I, bishop, will recognize your church if you pay me taxes.
Oh.
And recognize me as your secular lord, not as your religious lord. Halberstadt, the same thing. Herman van Veed, who is the Cardinal Archbishop of Cologne, one of the electors, switches sides and becomes a Lutheran, even inviting Bussière to come and preach in his diocese. There are a number of other German cities that go over to the Protestants at this point too. And just in the middle of all of this, and you remember the alliance that France had?
Mm-hmm.
It included Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
So who would automatically be on the other side? England.
Right.
Henry VIII, of all people, turns to Charles V and joins in the alliance on his side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a kind of despicable group. I mean, you know, Charles would have to really swallow hard to bring this guy in. This is the guy who divorced his aunt.
Right.
You know, and took the Catholic Church, it took England out of the Catholic Church, and yet he needed these allies,
mm-hmm.
An ally so much that ultimately he accepts Henry as an ally. There's a peace that's brought about in 1544, and Cleves is isolated, and the whole Protestant plot caves in.
How did they do that?
It was just maneuvering.
And just the political aspects of it kind of just shut it down.
Yeah. I mean, you know, comes a point in time when people realize
you've got more power than we do, and so we have to.
And it just goes back and forth like that.
Wow.
6 months later, after this European peace is signed, the Council of Trent is opened, and we'll talk about Trent a lot in our next program. Just an incredible council; it's so important. Even as the Council of Trent is forming, the Lutherans then respond by even hardening their positions even more around the Augsburg Confession and around Luther. Even Protestant, non-Lutheran Protestant theologians and churchmen begin calling Martin Luther the Lutheran Pope because he's got such influence. He's become a counterforce in the church. Now, this is very interesting, of course, if we go back to that theory of the radial and tangential movements within church history. The radial energy is certainly, I mean, coming toward the radius, coming toward the center, coming toward Trent, Paul III, bringing the church back together again in Trent. The opposite, of course, is going to be the tangential energy, which, of course, Luther represents. And yet he's trying in his own way to be a radius, to being a center, a root. And it's not going to work, obviously. And the other Protestants resent him for trying to do that. So you find the situation. It's at this point that Charles is confident enough that he backs off of his previous promise at the Nuremberg Recess.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
And he says, I'm suspending the Nuremberg Recess. The clock is ticking. It's time for you guys to get back on board and become Catholic again.
Uh-huh.
He feels confident enough to do that. The Schmalkaldic League now ratchets it, its own stuff. And this is where the first Schmalkaldic League, the first Schmalkaldic War takes place.
Okay.
They hire a mercenary general, a pretty good, best general in Europe at the time, and they promise him an army. Three states, the state of Saxony, of Hesse, and Württemberg, all send troops to help him. Ultimately, Charles begins to think maybe he made a big mistake because he's standing up against 57,000 Lutherans. An army of 57,000, and he looks over at his imperial army, he's got 6,000.
Oh, man.
You know, he's pretty outnumbered. Well, what saves Charles in all of this is that as the Protestants gathered together with this huge army, with this great general, all of the leaders of these various municipalities and princedoms begin arguing with each other over strategy.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
So they vetoed each other. And so as they're arguing and their troops are sitting at 57,000, Charles is slowly gathering troops from Bavaria and other parts of southern Germany, from Italy, from Spain, all of these, Austria, all of these coming together. There is now one great big battle of Christians against Christians, and it takes place at an area called Mühlberg. It takes place in April of 1547, and it is a smashing victory for Charles. The Catholic imperial forces win this battle easily. Interestingly enough, the Protestants have a better army, the Protestants have a better general, but Charles is able to pull it off. Philip of Hesse is captured on battle.
Wow, okay.
He gives himself over. Once again, he's playing these games. He turns over to Charles and he says, take my person. I know that you will take care of me and all this kind of stuff. Well, he was sent to prison in the Netherlands. And Charles instead is absolutely triumphant.
Uh-huh.
Now he returns down into Italy. He is a victorious emperor, set on controlling reforming the church and controlling the reforming of the church with the consuls itself. Here he has some difficulties with the Pope because Paul III is not about to turn over the consul to Charles. Because and this is a very wise move, because Charles is still a politician.
Uh-huh.
And what he's looking at is he wants to take control. Now he's the victorious emperor on the battlefield. Now he wants to be the victorious emperor at the consul. Okay. Now remember what Sigismund did when he called that consul?
Mm-hmm.
He stepped back. He didn't try to run it. Charles is trying to step in and say, now look, if you just go ahead and compromise on this scripture thing, what's the big deal?
Oh.
You know, the Eucharist, what's the big deal? I don't understand. You know what? You know? And so there's definitely, I mean, there are definitely differences.
Right.
Not able to take over the consul, he then forms together his own theological statement,
okay,
that it takes place in what he calls the Augsburg Interim, and this is in the summer of 1548. And basically what it does is, first of all, it makes celibacy optional,
okay,
for clergy. It allows for the reception of communion under both species.
Okay.
And once again, so we're dealing with some surface issues,
mm-hmm,
here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It allows for various variations in an understanding of what justification is. Now, interestingly enough, Catholic and Lutheran understandings of justification are not that far apart. Luther kind of presses it to the extreme by going with this concept of faith alone. But there is enough understanding that in 1999, at the agreement between the Evangelical Church and the Catholic Church, we have a common understanding of justification. So that was not that too terribly possible. And then the other thing that he suggested also was an understanding of the Pope as the supreme bishop, whatever that means. You know, and so that's kind of amorphous.
Mm-hmm.
And then an avowed need for reform in the church.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what the Augsburg Interim was. He turns to the Protestant princes and presents this and says, what do you think about this? And a number of Protestants are won over to it. They're saying, yeah, we'll be willing to come back to the Catholic Church under those circumstances. And those are not too terrible circumstances. I mean, when you look at it, the Lutherans, however, the hard line, respond back with what they call the Leipzig Interim,
okay,
in which they take a much stronger position. And ultimately what happens is you end up with three different positions,
mm-hmm,
in a very uneasy peace. I mean, they're still in a state of war. They've only had one battle, but they're still in a state of war. It could break out at any time. You've got the Pope, Paul, who's putting everything on Trent. You've got the Habsburg, Charles and the Habsburgs, who are putting everything on the Augsburg Interim. And then you've got the Lutherans with the Leipzig Interim. Everything is in a stalemate until Paul III dies.
Okay.
He is replaced by by Julius III, who is Pope for 5 years, from 1550 to 1555. The Council of Trent is suspended, as we'll talk about a little bit later on. It comes back in a second assembly a little bit later. It only is there for about a year, and then it has to fall again. It has to close again. We'll talk about how that happens. But in the process of all of this, you have three of the Schmalkaldic lords once again go to war against Charles. They conquer a section of Germany called Franconia. Charles flees to Austria, and ultimately the Council of Trent is threatened. It has to close its second assembly, and then it's going to be many years before it comes back again. Julius III dies in 1555. He succeeded Marcellus II, who is probably best known for the Palestrina Mass, the Missa Marcellus, because he dies 1 month later.
Wow.
You know, so there's just a real succession. And then Paul IV becomes pope in 1555. He remains pope for only 4 years. This sort of reminds you of that early, as we were starting with church history.
Changing.
Yeah, these constant changes that are taking place. Ultimately, what is going to happen up in Germany is that the princes will gather together in a diet, and they're going to hammer out a compromise, something that is going to bring peace to Germany. They're fearful of this Schmalkaldic War re-inflaming again, more people being killed in the name of Christ. They just didn't want to see that happen.
Uh-huh.
And so in 1555, in September, they gathered and they came up with a compromise that's called the Peace of Augsburg. And it is signed off by Ferdinand, who has now become the emperor of the Habsburg Empire. It's at this point that Charles has given up any control of the Germans, and 1 year later, he'll give everything over to his son, Philip, among the Spanish. So he's in the midst of abdicating.
Uh-huh.
So Ferdinand then goes ahead and accepts and promulgates the Peace of Augsburg.
Now Ferdinand is Charles' brother.
Brother, okay. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. This is a very important statement. It really sets the atmosphere for Christianity from then on. And when Warren Carroll speaks of the cleaving of Christendom, that's exactly it. It's not the cleaving of Christianity. He uses the term cleaving of Christendom,
mm-hmm.
You know, that sense of a united Christianity. It really is cleaved at this point and permanently. The first thing that's accepted, that they all accept, is that the Lutheran princes, the knights, the Lutheran cities are all guaranteed security equal to Catholics. To use the term of the treaty, with eternal unconditional peace.
Okay.
So Lutherans now are going to be accepted as full-fledged Christians right alongside of Catholics.
Okay.
It's now going to be, I wouldn't say illegal, but certainly impolitic to refer to Lutherans as heretics anymore.
Okay.
Okay. At least politically, they're going to be recognized. Secondly, each estate has the right to choose. Each section or principality has the right to choose to either be Catholic or Lutheran. Ultimately, the policy is going to be referred to by legal scholars as cuius regio eius religio, which means that the prince of an area will choose maybe to be Catholic.
Okay.
Then what that means is that everybody in that district must become Catholic or they must leave. Another district, Lutheran. And that's why even to today in Germany, the Catholicism in Germany is mainly in the southern Germany, Bavaria, and the western part of Germany. Northern Germany is very heavily Lutheran. Northern and even eastern Germany is heavily Lutheran, and it still maintains itself today.
Wow.
I remember visiting a city in Baden-Württemberg, the city of Ulm. It's a beautiful old medieval city. It has a cathedral there which has the highest cathedral steeple in the world. And once when I was younger, I was brave enough to climb to the top. I won't do that anymore, but I did back then. That city is in Baden-Württemberg, which was a Protestant district, and it is probably, even to this day, 80 to 85% Lutheran. Across the Danube River, which is a very small river at that point, across the Danube River, and you can easily walk over a walking bridge, there's the little city of Neu-Ulm, of New Ulm. It's in Bavaria. That's Danube is the dividing line between the state of Bavaria and the state of Baden-Württemberg. In Bavaria, Neu-Ulm is probably close to 90% Catholic.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's even to today. Mm-hmm. And so there's this divide. And that all goes back to this peace treaty of 1555.
Wow.
The third agreement was that all church lands before 1552 that were in Lutheran hands would remain in Lutheran hands.
Okay,
so they inherited a massive amount of property. All of the lands then that had been in their hands 3 years prior to the peace treaty now would remain. It's one of the reasons why many of the great cathedrals in Germany are Lutheran,
mm-hmm.
Because they had seized these. In Germany, a Catholic cathedral is referred to as a Dom, D-O-M. The Lutheran cathedrals are referred to as Münster. And so you can tell a Catholic from a Lutheran cathedral. Sometimes it's the only way you can tell.
Huh.
In fact, in Ulm, at the Cathedral of St. Michael's, if you walked in, you would think you were in a Catholic church. It's only because of the designation Münster that you would know that it's a Lutheran cathedral instead.
Wow.
And then finally, I'm sorry, go ahead.
They would have removed any statues or anything then, though, wouldn't they?
There is a huge, you know, I've got a certain devotion to St. Michael, as you can well imagine. There is a huge statue of the Archangel St. Michael right in the center of that church. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really is. Because I never attended any of the services there, so I don't know what those were like. But as a tourist, you would be hard-pressed to tell the difference. Now, honestly, I don't remember, and it's just a failure of memory, whether or not there's a tabernacle and
in
tabernacle
light.
I don't think so, but I don't remember not seeing it.
Uh-huh,
and it didn't strike me at the time, or maybe I don't remember.
Well, and sometimes in those bigger churches and cathedrals, it can be hard to find.
Yes, that's very true, especially those churches that are used more for tourists. That's right. Well, then the fourth element was that any other ecclesiastical prince, that is to say a bishop or abbot, who decides to switch sides
from
after that point on can go, but he can't take his stuff with him.
Okay.
Well, basically, and the important thing behind all of this, of course, is that Lutheranism now is accepted as a legal body equal in rank to the Catholic Church. Never in Christian history has that ever been done before. This is the beginning, and this will set a precedence, of course, for state religions other than Catholic state religions all throughout Europe in the years to come.
Amazing.
It is. Charles abdicates, as we talked about before, to his brother Ferdinand. His son Philip retires to a monastery and then receives extreme unction.
Mm-hmm.
He an interesting story here also. He wanted to go to Mass one last time, and his doctors told him no. And the monks at the monastery said, oh, no, you don't need to do that. You've received extreme monks and all that. And his response was, he said, I think it would be very helpful for my final journey. He did attend the Mass and, as I mentioned before, went back to his deathbed with the portrait of his wife in his hands and breathed his last.
Wow. Beautiful. Well, Father, I think that's a perfect way to end, so we close today.
Okay, great. Well, why don't we just say a little a prayer. Glory to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was
in the beginning,
is now, and ever shall be.
A world without end.
Amen.